Are you ready to take your podcast journey to the next level? Then you're going to want to check out On Air Fest 2025, the premier festival for sound and storytelling. On Air Fest 2025 is where multimedia creators gather to elevate their craft while celebrating their community. Taking place in Brooklyn, February 19th through the 21st, On Air Fest 2025 features 3 days and four nights of live podcasts, performances, and parties. And this year's lineup is bigger than ever, featuring tech queen Taylor Lorenz, SNL's James Austin Johnson, Death, Sex, and Money's Anna Sale, and over 200 creators and storytellers. And because Advertising Week is a media partner of On Air Fest 2025, and you're part of our crew, we invite you to use our code AW10 for 10% off your pass. Get your tickets now at on-air-fest.com, and be sure to use code AW10 to save. That's on-air-fest.com with code AW10. We'll see you there.
Welcome to Great Minds as we wind up a 5-year joyride of a lifetime. Otis, this is the last episode of 350, a 5-year series, five paling in comparison to the longevity of your magnificent career. And Otis, the trait that we always value the most amongst many are sustained excellence. And I can't think of anyone who lives a life of sustained excellence on stage, Otis, and off the stage than Otis Williams, founder and the last thriving and surviving member of the Temptations, the great Otis Williams. Otis, thank you so much.
Boy, those are some big accolades you're bestowing upon me. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, so well earned. So, Otis, so much to talk about. I'd love for you to trace sort of the journey for us going all the way back from the Siberians, the El Domingos, the Distance, the Elgins, that road to Motown and the Temptations. But it all starts with you, Otis. Everything starts, there's always a first something. And here, Otis, the first is you.
Well, you know, I'm a little, like I tell people, I'm a little country boy from Texarkana, Texas. I used to run up and down the gravel roads with coveralls on with one strap on one shoulder and hot water cornbread in my hand. And we run like I said, running barefooted. So to start off my life down in Texarkana, and then when my mother had me to come to Detroit when I was about 11 or 12 years old, that's really when it started because, see, I was raised by my two wonderful grandmothers. And grandmothers didn't play that rock and roll stuff because they, even down south in Texas, that was unheard of. So all I grew up listening was to Mahalia Jackson, the Swan Silvertones, Dixie Hummingbirds, you know, those great gospel singers of that era. But when I moved to Detroit, when my mother had me to come to Detroit, that's when I got turned on to, you know, rock and roll and the R&B and what have you. And it was unheard of for me because, like I said, being from Texas and coming up to Detroit hearing that kind of music, man, I was mesmerized. And then not only hearing the music, they started having a big rock and roll shows at the Fox Theater in Detroit. Now, I was about, must have been about like 12, 13 years old, and I went to see my first rock and roll show at the Fox Theater, and it was a big lineup, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Cadillacs, Jimmy Jones, John, come, that, and a lot of great acts on there. And see, the Fox, like I've always learned, seated at about 3,000 or 4,000 people. And for a little fella like myself, seeing that, you know, coming from Texarkana and saying, wow, look at all these people going crazy over with five or four guys or one singer doing on stage, I was mesmerized. So that's when I really said, oh, I think I like to do this. Not knowing that I was started a group, so we started a group because, you know, I wasn't doing no group thing down in Texas. But as fate would have it, you know, I was able to get some guys together and the slow metamorphosis of getting different guys and going from one group to another group. And it really started happening when my mother and stepfather moved to the west side of Detroit. So I grew up on the east side of Detroit. But once we moved to Detroit, to the west side of Detroit, that's when things really started happening, because little did I know that I would become part of Motown, you know. And one day I'm walking down Woodrow Wilson, and as fate would have it, I saw Melvin Franklin. Now, when I first heard Melvin Franklin, he was singing with a group called Needed. I met the Voice Masters, and they had a song out called Needed. And then they came back with Needed Part 1 and 2. I'll take that back. They came up with the first song, Hope and Pray. They didn't have a bass singer. So when they came back out with Needed Part 1 and 2, I heard boom, boom. So I'm saying, Voice Masters didn't have no bass singer sounding like that. And I was on a quest to find who that was. Come to find out, he was Melvin Franklin. He was just 16 years old, sounding like a little old man. And Melvin didn't go to school. He told me he skipped school and went to New York City with the Voice Masters and recorded Needed. And it was such a big hit in Detroit. You know, I was mesmerized. And little did I know that as time would have it, I would meet Melvin. So I'm walking down Woodrow Wilson. And I, like I said, I knew it was fate, because I'm walking out with Joe Wilson and I saw Melvin on the other side of the street. And I said, wow, that's the guy that I'm looking for. So I said, hey, man, I want to talk to you. We crisscrossed the street because, see, that part of Detroit over in there, 12, you know, if they didn't know you, meaning the fellas over there, they would clean your plow, you know. But luckily, knew who I was. And I'm walking up and down that area. But when I saw Melvin, him and I crisscrossed. I said, hey, man, slow up. I just want to talk to you about singing. And he thought I was a gang member, so he thought I wanted to, get over into with that. I said, no, I'm not in no gang. And as time would have it, we signed a deal with Johnny Mae Matthews. Now, Johnny Mae Matthews, he had this company called Northern Records. So one day, Melvin and Richard Street and Vernard Plain, we were walking down Lawton. And as we were harmonizing, walking down the street, Johnny Mae heard us and she said, oh my God, you guys sound good. And she invited us into her home and we talked and whatever. And she said, I would like to sign you guys up and let's see what we can do. So us being young, like I said, we were about like 17, 18 years old. We signed a deal with Johnny Mae. Naturally, being so young, our parents had to sign for us. And we came out with this record called Come On. Come On was a fairly sizable hit in Detroit in certain areas. Johnny Mae had her own recording company, like I say, called Northern Records. And so we went in and recorded it. And before we became the Distance, you know, we were the El Domingos. We were all kinds of names. But they didn't stay until we got to Johnny Mae. And one time we were called Otis Williams and the Siberians. Didn't like that one either. So we were talking about names in Johnny Mae's house, and a guy by the name of Al, he said, well, why don't you guys just call yourself The Distance? And that kind of resonated with us. And so Distance, yeah, D-I-S-T-A-N-T. Yeah, I like the sound of that. So Johnny Mae said, okay, well, we'll call you guys The Distance. Went in the studio and recorded Come On. And Johnny Mae, you know, released it. And it really became a big hit in Detroit. I mean, every time, you know, we were listening to R&B stations, you know, you would hear Melvin boom, 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 boom. I had that church thing and the tambourine and whatever. And so it was really huge in Detroit and certain key markets. The thing that Johnny Mae didn't have, she didn't have national distribution. So she went to New York and signed a deal with Warwick Records, which had national distribution. So she came back to Detroit, and she said, well, now that come on will be heard all over the country because they and Warwick Records has national distribution and what have you. And as she's telling me this, you know, she was counting out the money that she had got in New York. And so I said, oh, great. She just counted them in big $100 bills. And, you know, for a guy just 18 years old or thereabout, seeing all that kind of money, I said, okay, Jan. I said, do we get any royalties from that? And she stopped. And she looked at me like I was crazy for asking that. So I said, well, I'm young, but I did help write the come on. I mean, don't we get some kind of statement? She looked at me and she said, oh, this is my money. You ain't getting none of this money. This is mine, all mine. You're not going to get any of this. Little did she know, see, we used to do record hops back then. And we did this record hop at St. Stephen's Community Center. And Smoke and the Miracles was very huge, even at that time, you know. And they had Shop Around and a few other hits, and, you know. So Barry Gordy was, he came into St. Stephen's with Smoke and the Miracles. We were, distance, we were on stage at the time. And we could see even over that massive crowd of people, we could see Smoke and the Miracles and Barry Gordy. So I'm just saying my part. I'm saying to myself, wow, that's Mr. Gordy and Smoke and the Miracles. So when we had to do, they kept calling us back at least 3 to 4 times. But the third time, Franny Kerm, Ernie Durham was the disc jockey. And so we finally came off. And so I'm standing there getting ready to watch Smoke and the Miracles. And as fate would have it, Barry Gordy was standing not too far from me, and he said, I like that record that you guys have out. You know, if you should become unhappy where you are, come see me. I'm starting my own label. So he gave me his card. And like I said, when I went back and we were talking with Johnny Mae, and that's when she said, well, this is my money. You're not getting any of this money. And I said, well, we're young. We'll leave. We'll go somewhere else. She didn't know that we already had made contact with Mr. Gordy. So she said, well, if you leave, I'm taking the car. She had got us a 1957 Sky Blue Buick, and I named Otis Williams, and the distance on the side of the car was printed on, and bought the uniform. She said, I'll take all that back. My retort was, well, take it back. We young. We can start all over again. Little did she know that we were going to go to Motown. So we went to Barry, and he said, well, great. See Mickey Stevens. Now, at the time, Mickey Stevens was the A&R man for Motown. So Mickey Stevens took us downstairs in the basement with the piano, and we started singing. Now, at that time, the group consisted of, we lost Richard Street from the Distance Girls and James Crawford, which left Al, Brian, Melvin Franklin, and myself. So as fate would have it, I'm at home, and Eddie Kendricks call. Now, we had rehearsed and we knew Eddie, Paul, and a guy by the name of Kill Osborne. They called themselves the Primes. So Eddie had gone back to Birmingham, but he came back to Detroit, and him and I had connected before he went back home. So when he got back to Detroit, he said, hey, man, I'm back in town. What you doing? I said, well, man, you're right on time, because Eddie was a hell of a tenor, even at that young age. Then I said, we got a chance to sign with this up-and-coming recording company, Motown Records, and I need a tenor. He said, okay, well, count me in. He said, now, what about Paul? And I said, Paul? Oh, man, Paul couldn't sing his behind off, so bring Paul. See, Paul, Eddie, and Gail, they used to sing the A Foggy Day in London Town, hit me down, and they were singing that real sophisticated stuff. And I said, oh, okay, that's better singing something else other than the regular R&B, you know, stuff. So to have those two, to join Al and Melvin, I said, we really became a great asset, you know. So so they came over to my girl's apartment, and we started rehearsing. And the first song that I never will forget that we would practice was 100 Pounds of Clay by Gene McDaniels. And so one day as we were standing there and we just sang, we were singing gospel, we sang whatever we got the feeling for. So Paul said, look, we're not going to be the kind of group that just stand and sing. He said, no, we got to be exciting. We have to have movement. We have to sell sex. I never will forget, Eddie said, oh, Paul, you know, I'm stiff, man. I can't be doing all that stuff. So Paul said, we call him Cone because he liked cornbread. You say, oh, Cone, don't worry about it. You'll be all right. When we get through, you'll be looking like you should be looking. And like I said, we had signed a contract with Motown. In fact, I have my first contract still hanging up in my home because I was underage and my mother signed. I had to sign for me. And Mr. Gordy really was pleased with us. And they took us in the studio. And the first record that we made, see, we were going to record a company with recording a record with Johnny May called This Heart of Mine. But we said, no, we better come out with something else. And so the first record that we had with Motown was called Oh Mother of Mine.
Oh, Mother of Mine.
So they released it. We went out and recorded, and they released it. Motown released it, and it was all right. It didn't really knock down no doors or whatever. So Barry believed in it, so he brought us back into the studio, and we did another song called Check Yourself, which did fairly good. In fact, Barry heard it, and he joined. He said, I like that beginning, Otis. And he sat down at the piano, and he started mapping it out with Al, Melvin, Paul, Eddie, and Melvin and myself. And as we rehearsed it, Brian Holland, he said, man, I think I need to put a little lift in the song to give it another kind of, you know, lift. So when I listen at the song, even all the way now, and I listen to that, I said, wow, Brian Holland, Barry, and the Temps, you know, doing it. And it did a little something for us, you know. So Barry believed in us enough that he kept bringing us back into the studio. I see night after night when we perform. See, that's one of the things that I loved about Barry being at Motown. Most recording companies, if you did not happen within the first two records, stretching it three, they would drop you. You know, when you're costing us money, you know, we take you guys, and then you're not panning out to be what, you know, you should be or we want you to be. Barry didn't have that kind of thinking. He kept saying, it is not our fault, meaning the writers and the producers. He said, we have to do better. These guys can sing. So he kept bringing us back in. We did Dream Come True and a few others. And then when Smokey did I Want My Love, I Could See, and it was such a proper kind of a song, we said, oh, we got one here. We got one here. And it came very released, and then it did well. But it didn't make the top 100 like we had hoped. So at that time, we had David Ruffin, Eddie Kendricks, Paul Williams, Melvin Franklin, and myself. We were...
Otis, just stop for 1 second and talk about... I know Al left the band, great singer. Right. And I love how they talk about Al. And I've seen Ain't Too Proud so many times when it was on Broadway and on the West End. And I love how you tell the story. But the entry of David into the band, Jimmy Ruffin's younger brother, that was a big moment. Can we talk about David and what became the Classic Five?
Well, see, during the record hop days, you know, when Barry and him had us doing the record hops for Dream Come True and Check Yourself and Oh Mother of Mine, David Ruffin had a single out, you know, because he was a noted up-and-coming singer in Detroit, you know, and we did record hops together. And we were very impressed, you know, with David because aside from him being such a dynamic singer, you know, Ruffin would throw the microphone up, drop down to his knees, and he was a showman, you know, unto himself. And we started having a bond, you know, especially David and myself, because we used to, you know, hang together and go check out girls together and all that stuff like boys would do at the time. And we were having problems with Al. We were appearing at this club called, I can't think of the name of it now because it was going so far back. But the crowd was really knocked out with Paul, Eddie, Melvin, Franklin, and myself. And I think Richard might have been in. Yeah. Anyway, we kept doing Shout by the Isley Brothers. So the crowd, they kept calling us back, kept calling us back. So about the third time, they kept calling us back. And Paul said, well, man, we can't go back out there anymore because what we're going to do, keep doing Shout. And Al said, man, they ain't calling. We got to go back. He said, what we going to do, Al? Shout again? It'll be the third time for us doing it. Al, I call him Geechee because he had the Geechee blood in him. If he got a little alcohol in it, oh, wow. And I was about the only one that he would listen to. So when Paul said we wasn't going to go back out, Al grabbed the bottle. He said, MF, I hit you with this bottle. And I knew Al meant that. I was off just a little stroke of being too late because I tried to catch his hand. But by that time, he hit Paul in the face with the bottle and cut Paul across the bridge of his nose. And I came out of the dressing room and I leaned up against the wall of the door, and Eddie, David, Melvin, they all said, what's wrong, Otis? What's wrong? I said, Paul, Al just opened Paul's face open with a bottle. And we went in there, and Paul was, you know, bleeding, and we rushed him to the hospital. Now, to show you the kind of guy Paul was, we felt that something was getting ready to happen for the Temptations, even at that young age. And I got to tell you how we came about the name Temptations, too, because we were nameless after we left Johnny May. And trying to think where I want to start from. Well, we left, took Paul to the hospital, and Paul was the kind of guy that I said, Paul, I got to let out, though. I said, we're not going to have that. I mean, that's too close, man. I thought you would, you know, he was going to be blinded for life, but as fate would have, he just crossed the bridge's nose, didn't bother his eyes. Paul was the kind of guy that said, no, man, no, we can't do that. I feel something is getting ready to happen. We're getting ready to make it. I said, you got to be kidding me. We're going to keep Paul? He said, man, trust me. We're getting ready to make it. I could feel it. Motown was believing in us. We were a part of the Motown Review shows at that time. So I said, okay, all right. When we were performing at the Fox at that time, and see how the crowd was reacting to the Temptations. So Paul and Melvin broke out into a move on the stage. And I said, come on, Al, man, let's get some of that, because the girls went crazy, the audience went crazy when they did that first move. Al said, no, we the pretty boys. We stayed back. We let them do it. And we just hold it down. When we came off stage, I walked right up to Al. I said, hey, man, you got to go. You got to go because you don't have the right spirit. And that's how and when David Ruffin joined Eddie Kentry, Paul Williams, Melvin Franklin, and myself. And that's what people start referring to us as the classic temps. And Smokey saw us, you know, and he had been taking us in the studio to, you know, do certain songs. So this one particular time, Smokey came back in town and he called. He said, oh, get the guys to come up to the studio. And it was a cold January night. And so I called David, Eddie, Paul, Melvin, and myself, and we were walking up to Motown, cold as hell that night. And David and Eddie and Paul was in front, and Melvin and myself was behind. And I said, I got a feeling this is going to be a unit that is really going to do something. So, okay, we walked to Motown, came there, and went upstairs with Smokey. And Smokey said, well, I got a song for you guys I think is really going to do it. So he passed the lyrics around. So we're sitting there in the chair, and I'm looking at the lyrics, and I'm saying, you got a smile so bright, it could have been a candle. I'm saying to myself, what kind of hokey mess is this? So Smokey took us downstairs, and we were, you know, when you got a smile so bright, You knew you could have been. So I'm listening to one that when we finished, I said, this man turned something that's nonsense and he made it sensical, you know, putting it in a very funny tone. But so the tips were working even at that time and with David. So we were up in Muskegon, Michigan. And we were, must have been up there for about 3 weeks, you know, working, trying to, you know, make sure what we do, I was doing was really well. We came back into Detroit, and the guy said, one of the executives said, man, where were you guys? Mr. Gordon's been looking for you guys. So we said, you know, we work, man, until we get that record. We, you know, we love singing, so we're up in Muskegon. He said, well, you guys got a hit. And it was just David and I that was up at the studio that time. And I said, really? You see, he brought them Billboard and Cashbox magazine, and we had jumped in with 76 with a bullet. Motown at the time had a long Chase Lounge in the lobby. And David and I, we sat down, and we started crying right there because David had tried, you know, about 4 or 5 singles as a solo artist. And I think we did about the same as a group. And when we merged, and saw that this was happening. From that day on, it was just, I mean, I can't even put it in the words the way things started happening for the Temptations. And it was so wonderfully well received as we were. They started referring to, even as of today, the classic Temps. And David was on it with us for 4 years. But that 4 years that we were together, we had hit after hit after hit. All kind of big TV shows, you know, Ed Sullivan, Hollywood Palace, you know, shows that we never would imagine that we would ever be a part of. And so it was such a wonderful thing to be a part of, you know, and Motown was really flourishing at the time. And, but you know, success, you find out what kind of person or people you're dealing with when success started, you know, really coming into play. And little by little, and I would never sit here and denigrate David, but David started changing, you know. And when Smokey came to see us at the 20 grand, and I tell you how my girl came about, and we had a big hit record with The Way You Do the Things You Do and I'll Be in Trouble. So Smokey Robinson and his wife, Claudette Robinson came to see us, and Smokey, we were backstage, and Smokey was talking about, oh, my God, you guys are phenomenal. The mood, man. Who taught you that? So we said, well, you know, we made it up ourselves. Now, Paul was the noted choreographer at the time. He said, man, you guys, y'all had the people going crazy over you. And then he stopped, and he looked at David Ruffin, and he said, I have a song for you. And like I tell people, we're young, cocky. And I remember bringing on, we can sing anything. We went to New York City, and we were at the Apollo Theater, Smokey and the Miracles headlining, and we were co-starring. In my home today, I have pictures where Smokey would, he was rehearsing us for My Girl. So we rehearsed in My Girl and got it down. And after we did the stint at the Apollo, we flew back to Detroit. And Smokey took us into the studio, and we put the vocals down to My Girl. And so I said, okay, Smokey wrote another great song because, you know, The Way You Do the Things You Do and I'll Be in Trouble. Well, you know, very good records. But when Paul Reiser added the strings and the horns to already great song, My Girl, when I heard Jamba, I said, this is going to be something else. Smokey was in the control room. And he was doing his producer's thing, you know, making sure the balance of the strings and everything was as it should be. I came in the studio and I said, "Smoking, I don't know how big a record this is going to become, but I must say this, this is going to be a big record." Motown released My Girl December of 1964. February of 1965, and I still have the telegrams in my home today. Barry sent us a telegram congratulating us. We sold over 1 million records. The Supreme sent us a telegram saying the same thing. Florence Ballard had won by herself. Jules Podell, who was the head man at the Copacabana, because we broke every existing record at the Copacabana. And when Spain was the guy, the stage manager backstage, you know, he said, "Otis, Temptation, y'all got a telegram down here." They had us way up at the top of the Apollo. You had to come down all those steps to get down and pick up if somebody was coming to see you, or a phone call or whatever. Well, I came down all those steps, and I got the telegram, and I read it. And I must say, "This is going to be mad." I said, "I'm not even telling." I said, "Hey, this is what we got, y'all." And I told them that we had a telegram from the Beatles. But that telegram from the Beatles, I still have it hanging up in my house today.
Oh, my God. Absolutely incredible, Otis. That time, that young time, and you referenced being on, you know, the Motown reviews, the shows, there was such an incredible family. Talk about some of those other bands and artists you all toured together and really grew up together.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. See, that unto itself is what made Motown such a unique company. You know, the Miracles, the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Mary Wells. We were doing dates together, you know. We'd all been on the upright bus, you know. And see, we traveled today with a lot of conveniences, you know, the bed, yeah, guitar. And, you know, "I'm going to lay it down." No, we're not laying down. And then you go and sit down, and you stay sitting up until you get to the next gig. You know, so, but we were young. We didn't care about that. We were happy that we were having fun. We were having success. We were selling out places, and we were selling millions of CDs and things of that nature. So it was great, you know, at that time. And, you know, we were touring the South, which sometimes would become very little to know, regardless of how successful and you would become. We came to certain places like my home state, Texas, and we came, got off the bus to come get us something to eat. You go and get us something to eat. And when they saw that it was all blacks, you know, one of them said, "Oh, we don't serve niggas." And we stopped and we said, "And we don't eat them." And we turned around and walked out and got back on the tour bus and found the place that would serve us. I never will forget, we encountered like a place, I guess it's where Daniel Boone was from, because we stayed at the Daniel Boone Hotel. And Four Tops, Tim's, Martha and the Vandellas, big Motown review lineup. And it got kind of bad there, because when the Tim's went on, the Tops were standing on the side of the stage ready to, if anybody came up there, you know, it was going to be a mess, I tell you. And we did the same thing, roll reversal when the Tops was on. So, okay, we finished the gig, but when we got back to the hotel and we were packing up my bus, and these white guys came by and they were, thank God none of us got hit. Nobody was hurt, you know. And little did I know how many Motownians would carry guns, because I saw David, the Four Tops, some of the Miracles pulling out guns, you know, but the guys drove off. And so we packed up the bus and we pulled on out of town. And so we had some very scary times, you know, back then. And but nevertheless, we were wrapped in God's clove for being who we were and trying to do something on a positive manner. And, you know, so, yeah, we were baptized in fire, you know. And here I am doing it, and I'm 83 years old and I'm still having fun with it, you know. But yeah, there's a lot to be told, you know, the stories. I mean, hanging with the Beatles over in England, or two of the Beatles anyway. So I become very reflective of the what I've been through and where we are today. You know, because most groups, they don't last that long. Yeah, I mean, we started in 64. Here it is, 80, 3, and I had to deal with 27 different strong personalities. And yet here I sit to tell you what I've been through and still enjoying the ride. That's the part, though. Yeah.
It's amazing, Otis. And we just saw you last month here in New York in the Capitol Theater up in Portchester.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And better than ever. And when we talked to your longtime manager and dear, dear friend Shelley Berger, you know, Shelley gives you all the props for having such a keen eye and ear for talent that you can never point in the history of the Temptations and say, oh, they weren't any good then. The Temps have always been great. And that's all you, Otis.
You know, like I said earlier, how I was raised, going to church and what have you. And when I become very reflective of what I've been through and still riding the hell off the horse, Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson, I will tell you, out of all the great singers that I've had, 27 different strong personalities, Berry and Smokey would say, if it wasn't for Otis Williams, there would be no Temptation. He said, regardless, he's had some of the singingest guys in the group, but if it wasn't for him, there would be no Temptation. And I said, well, I never thought of it like that. I'm just having fun, you know, and we making history, we were making money, we in sellout crowds, and the girls loving us, and the guys loving us, and what have you. So I didn't ego trip like that. All I ever wanted to do was just sing, and it got to be even greater than I would ever imagine.
Amazing. And Otis, as we start to wrap, I know you've got a show tonight, but you mentioned the Beatles and London, and I know that, you know, you're not just huge in Detroit and America, but the Temptations are global. You have touched every corner of the earth, and some early trips to London, they always seem to really get and love the Temps, maybe more than anybody.
Wow. You know, yeah, England, we have always been received wonderfully well over in England. I tell you, when we first went to Gdansk, Poland, you know, now we played there. That was 1978, thereabout. And just show you how, you know, we have a tendency to take certain things for granted. We stayed at the hotel, and as we were coming out of the hotel that we were staying in, you know, we've always been very fashion conscious, you know, certain clothes that we wear and how we would do our hair and all that stuff. So we came out of the hotel to go do the show. Some of the fans, they would come up to us and they would, ooh, look at this. Can I have this? Talking about taking the clothes that we had because they didn't see no fashionable clothes like that over in Gdansk, Poland. And we said, no, we can't do that because, you know, we have to wear this. And the thing that I also remember, staff of them marveling over the way we were dressed, you're talking about a country that is at the periphery of being next to Russia. As we were singing Papa Was a Rolling Stone, My Girl, some of our big hits, they were singing right along with us. So I'm saying, for a country that don't have no radio on that, no television, enough to know who we really are, but they knew who we were. But I asked, I said, how do y'all know about the My Girls and the Papas and whatever? We get y'all's record and music through Black Market. We heard about Motown and the Temptation. We had to get that to listen, and that's how we know about the Temptation and Motown, Black Market. And I said, wow, I never forgot that. I said, wow, never. See, we have a great tendency to take certain things for granted, you know. Go to another country. Go to another country that do not have all the wonderful things that we have been able to share and be a part of. And I never will forget that. And the clothes, like I said, they wonder, can we have this, you know, because we've always been prideful of the way we were dressed and what have you. So when you go out of the country, you know, especially to Gdansk, Poland, and then we went through South Africa, you know, certain countries that give you a whole other kind of appreciation, you know, for how far-reaching music can be and the importance of, records and great songs, you know, because we've always prided ourselves on making great records. You know, we don't come out slamming no woman or B, you better give me this and that. No, we don't. We've never, Barry would even adhere to anything of that nature to begin with. And the Temps, I know for a fact, we were all gospel guys. We were raised from down in the South, and our grandparents and parents would teach us. Like I told you earlier, all I would ever hear was Dixie Hummingbird, Swan Silver Dawn, Mahalia Jackson, until I moved to Detroit. And then I started hearing the Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry's and the James Browns and, you know, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and the Drifters. I'm saying, wow, this is another kind of music. And I fell in love with it. And I still tell people when I would go to the Fox for a theater, and see, like I said, the Fox Theater is the second largest indoor theater in America. Radio City is the first. Being about 14 years old and seeing about 3,000 to 4,000 people going crazy over what Five Guys was doing on the stage, that left an impression on me. And about 3 or 4 years later, we were getting the same kind of love. And so the ride that I have been on and still riding, it's amazing. When you walk down my hall, there's a life-size picture of the classic Temps. My bass singer, Kerry Turman, has since passed on. But when he first came to my house and he started walking down in the hall, and I could stand up right next to him and I'd be the same life size if they were still alive today. Kerry stood there and he started crying. I said, well, really? Why? He said, Otis, you just don't know what you guys meant and still mean to people. Kerry's been gone for, how long? About 5 or 6 years.
Six years, yeah.
6 years. You know, so, I'm still having a wonderful time, you know, and I must say, Derek, I would always tell him I've had 3 great road managers. Don Foster, who since passed earlier, last year now. Don Peek, who's still top service, and Derek. And they all start with D's, you know, but because at the beginning, it was Melvin and myself that would have to pick up the money and make sure it's all counted there. Because back during the days, God rest his soul, but Teddy Powell, you had to watch out for him. We did this club for him, and Melvin and myself were the road managers. And so when we finished doing the show, Eddie, David, and Paul, and Cornelius, the rest of the group, would go back to the hotel. Melvin and I would have to stay there at the hotel and make sure it balanced out the last half of the contract of the money. And Teddy was the kind of guy, he put a few thousand, notables like 10, 15, you know. But the rest of it was all $1 bill. So Melvin said, no, we're not leaving you till we make sure you it's right. Oh, it's never, it's fine. We that's what we had, just a whole lot of ones, you know. So we wanted to, I said, no, we're going to count this out, because at the time, Barry had us, had management over us. And the company was called Itney, you know. And when Melvin and I would finish making sure that the balance was there, we would not get back to the hotel until about 3:30, almost 4 o'clock from college, you know. And that's why I said, with Derek and the other two, I don't take it for granted, you know. And I try and make sure the guys that I have now, hey, man, you know. So he's in a wicked position, you know, Don Foster. I'll tell you something about Don Foster. After we had let David Ruffin go, into Dennis Edmonds, David was trying to get back into the group. And security wouldn't let him pass to get on stage. And Don was one of the guys. No, you can't come. You can't, David, your time is up. David Ruffin slapped Don Foster so hard that Don came in. He had his handprint upside his face where David slapped him. And Don said, Otis, I took that one for the team. But if you do it again, I'm going to kill him. And he would carry a gun, because sometimes we had to make sure we wouldn't be getting robbed or whatever. And thank God that it didn't happen again. So, I mean, that's just a few of the highlights. I mean, I could go on and on about some of the things that I've gone through. And yet, God has let this group still persevere after all these years later.
Absolutely incredible, Otis. Just one more question, if you don't mind. Going back, you know, the writing that went from Smokey in the earliest days to the Holland Dozier Holland team and to Norman Whitfield, the Temps really had a voice. You've always been reflective of the times, really a mirror to culture. And the Temps had a voice. Songs like, you know, going back to the Vietnam War era, you had a message. Give us your perspective on the Temps as the evolution of the songwriting at Motown for the Temps, sure. And that you still have a voice today, Otis, and have perspective on where we are as a culture.
One of the things that I've been very blessed to have is guys in my group that could sing anything from five-part sophisticated harmony, don't mention about gospel, and then pop, and naturally R&B. You know, so we were able to do just about any kind of thing, you know, when it would come for us excelling, you know. Now, I'll tell you how we got over to Cloud Nine. You see, we were the first act and the only act at that time to win a Grammy. Kenny Gamble and I, we were in New York City talking. Kenny Gamble, Gamble and Huff. And so we just talking about records and what have you. And then we started hearing dun 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 dun. So it cut into our conversation, and I'm saying, "Who the hell is that? That's different." And so we listened, and then this jockey at the song was over. He said, "That's a new one by a group called Sly and the Family Stone." And I listened at that, you know, and we flew back to Detroit, and Norman Whitfield was our producer at the time, and I said, "Hey, Norman, there's a new sound. Maybe we should try it because we did the My Girls and I Wish You Would Range and whatever." I said, "Let's do something that's different." So Norman, being Norman, you'd have to know Norman. I loved him. Him and I grew up together. But he could be cocky. "Oh, man, shoot. We're going to say, yeah, I'm bull on that." You know, he just rant and rave about that Sly and the Family Stone sound. Went out of town. Came back in town, back to Detroit, and he had recorded the track to Cloud Nine. So now I said, "Oh, I'm not going to just let him pass without getting some fluff from me." So I said, "Oh, no, you didn't want to do that kind of stuff. That was garbage. That wasn't no song." "Oh, man, shut up. Come on, let's go on and record this." We went in, recorded Cloud Nine. We were the first act to win a Grammy for the Temptations and Motown. You know, so we have always been that daring kind of a group that we would do songs that a lot of groups are like, "I'm not so recorded. That sounds like a bunch of BS. No, I have always had guys that could sing anything that a producer would come up and say, "Hey, I want to do this here. Who can do it?" And you write it down. We say, "Okay." All Eddie, David, Mel, even me, if it were to become that. See, my thing, reason I didn't worry about leading, because I was one of the lead singers when we started out with the Distance, you know. But my focus has always been, I want us to have a hit. I want us to be successful. I don't care who's doing what, long as it is the Temptations. And that's been my attitude, and pretty much I still feel that way today. And by me having those kind of guys that could sing anything, I mean, from modern harmony, jazz, we could sing whatever that a producer would say, "Hey, I got something that's kind of different. Can I wonder if you guys can handle it?" So once they would sit down at the piano and show us we could do it. That has been the strength of the Temptations. We were not like just one man could sing anything, but they could. That was it. Eddie with his sweet tenor singing self, because, you know, they're talking about Eddie being the premier tenor of all time. That's a heck of a compliment, because when you stop thinking about some of the notable tenors that have existed, but they refer to Eddie as the premier tenor. I just read that a few days ago. David could sing his behind off and drop the microphone and come up, and, you know, that kind of dynamic. Now, Paul Williams, another story. We were at the Copacabana. Adam Clayton Powell came to see us. Now, we had already played the Copa and broke all existing records, and here we are again. And when Paul started singing "For Once in My Life," the room became hush. He would emit so much emotion that you couldn't help but say, wow, this brother's got a lot of soul and a feeling. Adam Clayton Powell stood up with tears running down his eyes, and he was applauding us and mainly Paul for saying "For Once in My Life." And once Adam Clayton Powell stood up, the whole audience at the Copacabana stood up, and they gave us a standing ovation. So I've always been surrounded by guys that could say anything and could deliver it with the right kind of meaning and things that a song of that ilk should encompass, you know, and do. So it's just, I tell people, this really is God's group, because 27 different guys, and most of them quit after two or three. We started in 1961. It is 2083. Ain't nothing wrong with that pitch, Jim. That pitch is bad. God did this here because we have shot ourselves in the foot and all kind of things, and yet here we are. And the people still love this group, you know, still, you know. And I guess that's the role God said, oh, this is you're going to do it. I'm going to be there for you. And he has backed me up.
Well, Otis, it's amazing and so inspirational. As I referenced, we just saw you last month, and I love how after the show is over and you had the Four Tops opening and then the Temptations, and just an incredible night, you stay there, you shake every hand, you say hi to the fans, the older ones, the younger ones, every generation there to see you. And that connection, Otis, that you have with the fans and that you still bring it every night. We saw you on the Today Show, saw you at the Macy's Day Parade, saw you during the baseball playoffs. Amazing. And it's all a tribute to you, Otis. And I can't thank you enough for sharing your story with us. And I can't think of someone on the planet I'd rather talk to more than you to finish this Great Mind series.
Well, I love telling about the Temptations' existence and how I started. Not, like I said, country boy running up and down gravel roads barefooted. And here I am now living the way I've been living. You know, that's never happenstance. You know, I'm going to point this out, and I know God has been really real in my life. And this is one day last year now, maybe even before. Derek and I were going to, I think, my knee doctor. In L.A., and we're going Coldwater Canyon. And I always mention this because Michael is real, the angel. We got up to the top of this part of Coldwater Canyon. There was a car in front of us. And when the light turned green, it was a young lady and a guy. And they're going for the go ahead on drive. The brother got out of the car, came up to Derek and myself in my truck. And I said, hey, man, we're not going to do this. We're not going to do this. And I'm doing my hand like this. And, you know, you would have thought that he was part of a Marine Corps the way he did the prettiest pivot, turned around, got back in, and they drove down. What if, see, we didn't carry nothing, Derek and myself. We didn't have no gun or no knife. He just got out without a gun. What if he had got out with a gun? We hear something here. Oh, okay, this is how it's going to be. Bam, bam. So when I look back on that, I told Derek, I said, that was Michael. God wanted his gift. That's right. You know what? I said, he was there. It could have got to be very bad. But they got the way he turned around, got back in the car, and they drove on down. I said, that was Michael. God had him said, no, you're not going to bother those two guys. And drove down. I always think back to them because could have got nasty. But he got out with nothing, and we didn't have anything.
Well, thank God you're still with us, Otis, and look forward to seeing you again on stage. Anytime we're in town, where you're playing, we'll be there. And it's a joy to talk to you, Otis.
Back at you. I love talking.
Take care, man.
Girl, this I can stand, 'cause I wanna keep you any way I can.